This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandergood.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. The Department of Land and Natural Resources just proposed a cap on the number of hikers to Hena State Park on Kauai. The issue is about protecting our natural resources from being overrun. If the restrictions are put in place, it would be the first time for a state park. The city already does something similar for Hanauma Bay, which sees more than 1 million visitors each year. The National Park Service has also imposed restrictions at Haleakala to protect endangered species.
For an outline of the issue that we're going to be asking our listeners to discuss with us today, I spoke yesterday with Sumner Lacroix, research fellow of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization.
In Hawaii, I think that the biggest problem that we face, really, though, is managing specific problems. There's a lot of specific site problems. We're starting just to see overcrowding at specific sites. I think one of the lessons of Professor Mack's paper on overtourism is that it's a lot better to try to manage these sites, to try to deal with the problems prior to the problems emerging at these sites than after they do emerge. Once they do emerge, then we're just finding the resource has already been somewhat degraded. The crowds are already there. There's just tremendous problems in trying to all of a sudden say, okay, let's back off from this overcrowded, degraded resource to managing a resource well. There's some examples, too, I think, where we've seen the problem, and the state has moved to try to come up with a master plan for various sites. Haena State Park on the north shore of Kauai is a really good example, the area now that's been hit by the floods. Mm-hmm. There's a master plan that's online that was developed by various stakeholders. And when you read over the master plan, it's really amazing. They've cataloged the cultural and natural assets well. They've come up with some really good ideas for how to transport people around without overcrowding the highways. They've looked at possibilities for entrance fees, for differential levels of parking, tourists vs. residents. But then at the very end, when I looked at it, the economist looking says, okay, how much is this going to cost? Where's the financial plan? There's nothing like that there. It's also not clear what's the next step. So yeah. This master plan is prepared. Is it another plan that's just going to sit on the shelf? In some ways, I think it's a bit of a leadership crisis. And I'm not really trying to talk just about the current government, but I think this really stretches back all the way back to the 1990s. Yeah. We've had a really difficult time dealing with this issue. There's difficult choices to be made, but if we don't make them at all, then we're left, I think, with the tragedy of the overcommons. We're just left with these resources not being appropriately managed.
That was from an interview yesterday with Sumner Lacroix of the Economic Research Organization of the University of Hawaii. You're back with The Conversation, and we're asking listeners to call in and join us by phone. Numbers to call are 941-3689, 877-941-3689. Joining us in the studio are Kurt Cottrell, administrator of DLNR's Division of State Parks, and Alan Hong, former manager of Hanauma Bay. Welcome to our studio.
Mahalo. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
So you heard our economists kind of give us a snapshot. Do you agree with that assessment?
Painfully, yes, in many of the elements that he talked about. Haena is a unique opportunity, and one of the things Sumner said that I'm adamant to try to ensure doesn't happen, and he's right, there's a lot of plans that the state has created. We have, you know, bookshelves of them in our state park library that due to either a lack of capital money to follow them or the plans become obsolete, they just sit on the shelf. Haena is a really unique opportunity for us right now, and nature intervened in a way through the floods that, and one of the other things that Sumner said is, and typically this is very true, we're doing triage on places after the fact. Mm-hmm. You know, we never envisioned when the state park system was developed this amazing, robust tourism industry driven by marketing and social media. So our parks statewide are all beyond the capacity envisioned. But at Haena, working really closely with community stakeholders and Alan Carpenter, our assistant administrator, gets a lot of credit because he spent a lot of time doing the legwork with the community on what is it we want? What do we want to see? And Haena used to be, before the closure and the flood, typically 2,000 people a day.
Wow.
The last census we took of hikers going from Haena into Hanakapiʻi was over 500,000 a year, and that was data from 10 years ago. we haven't had the opportunity to do a new census. And so in the midst of this planning process where we want to go from 2,000 a day and try to bring it down to 900, Mother Nature intervenes and the park is closed. The road gets wiped out. And so in effect, we have this really odd opportunity to go from soup to nuts and start over. Here's my problem. Here's the problem that is of critical urgency right now. It's kind of a race. The visitor industry is, I'm thinking, eager to repopulate Haena and redevelop, you know, the tourism
sure.
sector on that side. The DOT is repairing the road through Wainiha. The road will be repaired before we start the park improvements necessary to host visitors. And we have a governor's proclamation. So under the proclamation on disaster time frame, we don't have to go through a procurement and whatnot. We have the money kind of cobbled together of about $2.3 million of capital funds and general funds that we're now feverishly trying to encumber to fix the engineered wetlands that host the bathroom, the water line, the parking lot. Kalalau Trail got hit in several places. So both Napali and Haena ostensibly will be closed when the road opens. And that is an optic that we are still trying to figure out what to do and how to deal with it, because it'll be like the Oklahoma land rush of people trying to come back in to a park that's dysfunctional.
That's a really interesting snapshot. I mean, given what we've seen over the past month or so with how they're trying to recover, and then we have the message from HTA about, you know, we've got cancellations for the summer for tourism and the efforts to try and counter that. So
right.
You're really struggling to get your arms around that, Uncle Wei.
Yeah, quickly, in a really quick manner.
And, you know, Alan, you're the former manager of Hanama Bay, and of course, you presided over a vast expansion of Hanama Bay as a visitor attraction, and now every day Hanama Bay is at capacity by, what, 9 in the morning?
Well, I'd like to change that a little bit, Chris. We didn't actually develop Hanama Bay to become a major tourist attraction. Matter of fact, in 1990, we passed some major restrictions to help demote Hanama Bay mm-hmm. as a visitor destination, because we used to get over 3 million visitors a year, 3.4 million, 3.2 million in 1988, and which equates out to over 8,000 a day, whereas a figure that we had gotten from DLNR as to how many we should let in at Hanama Bay per day was less than 1,500.
Wow.
And our counts had shown that on busy days there were over 5,000 people at one time on the beach, the majority of them being brought in by tour buses.
Mm-hmm.
So we passed some restrictions in 1990, essentially, unfortunately, targeting the travel industry to help reduce the impact that was occurring to both the ecological system along the shoreline and to the social enjoyment of being in Hanama Bay, because it was much too crowded.
Sure.
So these restrictions went into effect, and in the very first year we reduced the attendance from over 3 million a year to 1.4 million, and each year we continued to get it down 100,000 more per year until I retired in 2011, and it was less than 900,000 per year at that time.
Now, the city and county really kind of led the way on this, though.
Yeah.
Yes, because the jurisdiction of Hanama Bay is all the water part of it belongs to the state under DLNR. And they
also, ironically, it's a underwater state park, but
yes.
But we've never really dealt with that.
And the state also has the highway, Kalana-Anoli Highway, but the land in between the highway down to the water's edge belongs to the city and county under the jurisdiction of the Department of Parks and Recreation, who I worked for 35 years.
So we've got a situation where the city and county is doing something. The state is now stepping up to try and do the same thing on Kauai. Can we safely say that maybe this will just be the first of other state parks?
Well, you know, first of all, Alan gets a lot of credit because they were way, way ahead of the curve at Hanama Bay. And I had no idea. The stats you just read off are staggering because we're at 3,000 people a day at Diamond Head, which is our highest ever. We never saw that coming. I didn't realize you guys were managing those kind of numbers way back then. And so the credit to you guys for coming up with this process and to ostensibly protect the quality of the MLCD and eliminate the Wonder Bread crumbs and the frozen peas that I heard were being distributed in staggering amounts. But to answer your question, we're going to give it a shot at Haena. There is a very big push due to the traffic issues, and that's really, really what it's coming down to. We have resource impacts. We have quality of experience, as Alan alluded to, impacts. But the primary big impact is to the local communities due to cars and traffic.
There's a caller on the line who addressing the very subject you folks are discussing. Toby, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, so my question is, it's a ConCon year, and in an effort to provide funding to DLNR, if the Hanama Bay model of charging a fee to visit a site were applied to all popular waterfalls, beaches, trails in the state to fund the upkeep of the ecosystem, would we need to change our constitution?
No. No, actually, that's a really good question, Toby, and it's one of the things we've been bouncing around. Already under our Hawaii administrative rules for the Division of State Parks, we have legal authority to charge at Haena. We have legal authority to charge at Koke Waimea. We're already charging at the Nu'uanupali, Akaka Falls, Hapuna, and of course Diamond Head. We started that over 15 years ago. The way our rules are set up is, unlike Diamond Head where everyone pays, for example, at Haena, we will be able to charge, I can't recall if it's a parking or entrance fee, but following Hanama Bay's lead, we're not charging residents. We're only charging the out-of-state visitors for the parking or entry. So, no, we don't need to do a ConCon. Our rules have all of those entitlements in place. The tricky part is setting up the mechanism to collect the fee. That's really the devil is in the details. And the way we've typically done it is we've contracted out to parking services like the Pali Lookout. You know, we put out a proposal for bids. We get a bid. And like at the Pali now, we generate about $250,000 of desperately needed cash for state parks. And the bulk of that money is coming from the big bus tourism industry. And this is the dynamic. If we don't get enough money directly from, say, the hotel room tax to state parks to manage our resources, we've had to directly extract that money from the visitor industry itself on site at the state park. So Eau Valley, we collect roughly about $250,000 to $280,000 a year. Akaka, we collect. Hapuna. In sum total, the money we're collecting from pretty much out-of-state visitors, excluding Diamond Head, which generates about $1 million a year from everybody paying, is equal to about another $1.5 million. All that money goes back into the state park system. And so because our budget has been so underfunded, we've been forced to be entrepreneurial and directly interface with the tourism industry on-site to collect the money. And it's actually worked really well because visitors are sensitized to paying fees because virtually all other municipal and federal parks, they all charge. We've been kind of giving our resources away for years and years at Hawaii, and the quality of our parks reflects that. So we're now forced to look at different models to generate income for better management, and Haena is going to be one of those where we will charge.
And Alan, we're sitting here and you're shaking your head. In affirmative.
The Hanama Bay put in an admission fee starting in 1995, and it was the first time here in Hawaii we were charging to go to a public beach, and we were really concerned about what type of reaction we would get from it. And whenever we make these decisions, we always think, you know, what does this do to the safety of our visitors? How does this affect residents getting into it? That's why we don't charge residents either at Hanama Bay, the admission fee. Mm-hmm. But all in all, it's turned out to be a fantastic success because visitors that visit a place like Hanama Bay and understand that the money is used to help protect and maintain Hanama Bay, they're almost every one of them is more than willing to pay that fee. They think it's a very positive thing, and a lot of them say, I wish our elected officials from my town would come up with creative things like this to help take care of places in my town as well. So I don't think there's going to be even though the travel industry will say it's good, it's not good for tourism, I think tourists understand that they want to help take care of a place like Hanama Bay or Haena and places like that.
I recall going down to Hanama Bay and feeding the fish frozen peas. And I have a friend who, after you instituted the no fees, no bread, you know, no feeding of the marine life, a parrotfish took a bite out of her knee and left a huge scar because
where's my peas?
Exactly, they were trained.
Yeah, exactly.
They were trained that this was, you know, free food diet.
Yeah, when the fish feeding was going on, we used to get injuries fairly regularly, and that has pretty much gone away now.
Wow, that's interesting.
I know. Yeah. First-hand experience, right?
You know, there's a caller on line two who has an interesting thought. Boyd from Kohala. Boyd?
Aloha.
Hi.
I attended the University of Hawaii at Manoa. I got a degree in Hawaiian studies. And one of the things I learned there was the perspective of the other Pacific Island nations about Hawaii and how it handled tourism. And as those nations started looking at tourism as an economic vehicle, they naturally looked at Tahiti and Hawaii as examples because we've been doing it longer already.
Sure.
And it's pretty much unanimous that Oahu is the worst-case scenario. You never want to let your island look like that in terms of the just the sheer development. And the impact on our site has been so tremendous that we are talking about places like Hanama Bay that I used to visit as a kid that are now, you know, sanctuaries because you have to protect them from the sheer onslaught. Other nations have much more restriction about how much and where the vacation industry, the visitor industry can be located. And in general, you can visit the other side of the island with a resident, but you shouldn't go wandering there by yourself. Please, you know, it's a respectful thing, but that's how they handle it. And we were talking about ecotourism in the past few decades and thinking about that as the way to go with Hawaii, and then we seem to lose sight of it. What these guys are talking about is that these are special, special places, unique in the world in many cases, and they deserve preservation, and they deserve an admittance fee, and they don't deserve tour buses coming up and just dumping off dozens of people that have no idea what it is they're really looking at. They're just taking pictures, dumping trash in the trash cans we have to empty in the parking lots we have to maintain, and then they leave, and they have really very little appreciation of what it is they just. So it would be way better if we could reduce volume and increase the intimacy of the visit for the visitor without having to be shared with all these other tour buses full of people.
Well, thanks for that, Boyd. I don't think there are too many people who would disagree with you. And one of the things that he alluded to was a shift in the very nature of tourism toward ecotourism, toward the traveler who stays at a bed and breakfast rather than a hotel, looks for economical ways to enjoy a vacation. And there's a whole sort of shift in that population, isn't there?
It's happened. I worked closely with the Hawaii Ecotourism Association in my previous job as the state trail manager. And we once thought, excuse me, that ecotourism would be the way to go. And Boyd is absolutely right. Problem is we have ecotourism and conventional tourism. We're having all forms of it all at once happening all at the same time. And the primary takeaway where this state, I think, has failed or needs to do triage on its tourism strategy is we've gone for quantity over quality. Mm-hmm. And that is a theme that's going to keep reoccurring. And our Hawaiian host culture values are not reflected in how we do tourism. It's widely known the impacts on resources just by the sheer pressure of humanity. But my narrative over at the legislature has been, and I've had to learn to speak in economic terms to get people's attention, we need to reinvest resources into the product. We need to take this image of Hawaii, this branding, and if we don't reinvest, we're going to tarnish that image. And I predict that the people will look for other destinations once they come and they see homeless people lined up on the streets and they have to wait for 20 minutes to get into Diamond Head and, you know, the whatever crime they have to deal with at some of our parks because their cars get broken into. And we're kind of at risk of you know, killing the goose that lays the golden egg, to go metaphorically on it. Unless we reinvest in a different model, we're like addicted to crack. Tourism for us is just this, we just keep wanting more and more, and we got to wean ourselves from that or we're going to kill the organism.
And Alan, you sat on the ecotourism board. What can you share about that approach?
The Hawaii Eco Tourism Association is a 23-year-old organization that was formed to try to educate the public about the tour industry conducting themselves in a way that minimizes the negative impacts to our culture and to our environment, because they saw tourism would be growing over the next 20, 30 years, and they wanted it to grow what they felt would be the least damaging direction. So it's made up of businesses in the travel industry who have taken on the mission of conducting their operations in such a way that they minimize their impact to our culture and to our environment. And that is, when they have customers, they try as much as they can to use recyclable goods, don't use styrofoam containers if they provide lunch, try to use electrical vehicles as possible, solar energy on their office buildings, et cetera, and to make sure that the information that they give about Hawaii, the history and the culture, is accurate, because there's a lot of misinformation out there that sells, but it's not accurate, and it dilutes the value of our culture.
And you talked about standards that they have set.
Yes. The Hawaii Ecotourism Association developed a certification program for tour operators, and if an operator meets certain criteria in how they conduct themselves, they will get the seal of approval from the Hawaii Ecotourism Association. And the Hawaii Tourism Authority actually helps fund that program. Mm-hmm. They see the value in doing that. And I myself, as a traveler going to someplace foreign, I wouldn't know which operator conducts themselves responsibly.
You would want to know that.
And I would, as a responsible traveler, I would like to find out. So a service like the Hawaii Ecotourism Association, which is nonprofit and not a business themselves, is valuable in that I could go to an organization like that, see which operators in their community would provide the responsible type of tour that I would like to give my business to.
Right, seal of approval.
Yes.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about protecting our natural resources. You can join the discussion by calling us at 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. And, you know, we did this week talk with the National Park Service about how it approaches protecting our natural resources. The Park Service did recently institute a reservations process to get access for sunrise viewing at Haleakala. And we talked to Charles Lassiter from the National Park Service.
So we have different ways that we manage the resource, not just through regulation, but also through a very active natural resource program that we have in the park. We have an extensive program here. That includes a vegetation team, an endangered wildlife management team. We also have a farm team that's responsible for all the perimeter fencing in the park. So in-house, you know, we do a lot here for species protecting and restoration. But as far as regulations go, as far as regulating, we have a very strict, strictly enforced stay-on-the-trail policy. And, you know, we want the public to realize that when they go off-trail here, there are consequences. They can really threaten the habitat that's out there for the endangered species, such as the silver sword. But in addition to that, you can crush burrows and a lot of small animals, you know, that you don't necessarily see every day with the naked eye that are important to the habitat up here or living under those rocks. So we're really key on enforcing that stay-on-trail policy. Another thing here is over 24,000 acres of Haleakala is actually a designated wilderness area by an act of Congress, and that's the highest level of protection that you can actually have. You know, it's an incredible amount of protection comes with that designation. No roads, permanent structures, anything that are allowed in designated wilderness areas, and you know, everything is pretty primitive in a wilderness area. We do have a sunrise reservation system in place right now that we implemented last January in 2017, and that's been going pretty good so far. And what happened is the crowd congestion at the summit, it was getting really overcrowded in the mornings. We have approximately 150 spaces for passenger vehicles in the summit area parking lots, and we were getting somewhere between 300 and 400 cars every morning. And so that was really threatening the resources. Also, you know, it's threatening the visitor experience because of the congestion, you know, short tempers, things of that nature. But in addition to that, too, we had people walking on and parking on the resources. And so we implemented that sunrise reservation system, and that's been going pretty well to this point.
So there you have it, the snapshot from the Park Service. Any ideas about the reservation system? Should we try something like that? Do you think that's doable, or is it just too hard to manage?
I think it's a necessity of the future. I think the Park Service did a really good thing. I used to live in Maui, and I'd go up to Haleakala for sunrise, and that was back in the 80s, and there'd be like 10 cars tops, right? And the numbers that he's talking about now, I can't even imagine. And again, it goes back to the quality of that experience, the sublime peacefulness of watching the sun come up over the crater compromised by 300 cars. It takes an event that the Park Service would want to maintain as a quasi-spiritual environmental event, and it turns it into a social media Instagram circus. You know, I can imagine all the phones in the air during sunrise, you know, which is a common thing that you see now. So for us at Haena, looking at what Alan's done at Hanama and what MPS has done for Haleakala, for the shuttle system, which is an element that is going to be key to see if we can maintain this targeted 900 people, we, at the request of the community, brought down the number of parking stalls in such a way that we want to incentivize the economics of a shuttle to work. Now, state parks, we don't run the shuttle, but we're setting up the park with our master plan, and ideally, during this closure period after the flood, prepare it for a shuttle to come in and turn around. And it's envisioned that the shuttle would be a reservation-based kind of system where a visitor would, you know, go online, get their shuttle ticket. You know, we could weave it into our entrance fee kind of thing. And if the parking is full at its reduced number, the only plausible way to get there is with the shuttle. So it's a leap of faith because there is no current shuttle in place, and there's got to be distribution modes, you know, from Princeville and whatnot to where people park. But for Haena, that using that model, that's a direction we're hoping we can, because it all comes down to enforcing limits, and you could do it with regulations, or you can do it through limiting access and transportation, providing other limited forms of transportation. So for our other parks statewide, we'll be looking, I think, if the visitor industry continues to run at its current pace, we have to figure out filters.
There's a caller on the line from Hawaii Island. Nicole, can you hear me?
I can.
What's on your mind?
Well, here in Pauilo, I live in Pauilo on the Hamakua coast, and we have the awesome blessing of having Kiliawe and Waipio Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since that loop, social media, of course, adds a lot of traffic to a lot of places, but ever since that blue book, Big Island Revealed, has come out, many visitors have been trespassing on people's lands and through their taro fields and plots to get to the back of Hile'ave, which is, you're not able to do that because it's private land.
Hile'ave Falls, you're talking about, at the
Hile'ave,
back of...
Yes, sorry, Hile'ave Falls, yes, mm-hmm. And there is a sign that is posted that says this is as far as you can go, or the rest is private, but people ignore it. And
Nicole, this is a book.
Down in Waipio Valley have found human waste, tampons, garbage, people, and when they don't want to ford the river, climb up onto their land and tramp through their fields, it's sad to see a resource like Kiliawe, which is so beautiful and so unique.
Nicole, you're saying there's a book that tells people to do this?
Well, I'm sorry?
Did you refer to a book that tells people to do this?
Yes. Well, there is a book, The Big Island Revealed, sold everywhere. It's they have one for every island, I believe, now. And it's called The Big Island Revealed. And the author says that there are kapu and no trespass signs, but it's okay to ignore them because... You know, he found some old plot map somewhere that said it was okay to go back to Hile'ave if you stayed on the river.
And Nicole, thanks for your call. Kurt, you're familiar with this.
Yeah, Nicole has talked about the 900-pound gorilla in the room. It started with the Revealed series. We've met with their production managers. It's very difficult to meet the owner. It's very isolated, but... Recently, they have made great efforts because they've been really bussed up by DLNR folks because they have one for each island. And they've been the bane of our existence in regards to sending people where they really shouldn't go, either for cultural damage, you know, resource damage, or their own safety. Unfortunately, even though they are now trying to change their narrative and they have an online version and they check with us more and more before they present information, they've been drastically replaced by TripAdvisor and Yelp and any plethora of social media sites that don't even try to act in a quasi-responsible manner the way the Hawaii Revealed guys. And here's a really good example, then I'll shut up so Alan can chime in. I recently had to send a fairly scorching letter to the head of National Geographic.
Really?
National Geographic has a few offshoots, and they're owned now by Fox News, I believe. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but nonetheless.
Too late.
Yeah, that's my strategy. So they have an online thing called National Geographic Adventures. And on my social media feed, I saw this image of that, and I played the video. And it was, would you walk this hike on Oahu? And they were directing people to the ridge that's above the Palipuka. Now, the only way you can get to either the Pali Notches or the Palipuka are through social trails that emanate from our park. Right. At both of those starts, we have signs that say closed area, you know, dangerous cliffs, whatever. And I looked at the number of views that National Geographic had attracted. Over 4 million views.
Wow.
Of people on the planet looking at what essentially is a ridge that's probably no more than 6 inches wide, with people walking with a selfie stick through the wind and clouds.
Unbelievable.
In a manner that almost challenged them, like, would you do this? And I commented online saying, please, 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 you don't know what you're doing. You're first of all, you're jeopardizing public safety, you're damaging resources, and you're putting first responders at risk who, you know, as Nicole's talking about, she probably didn't get into the fact that Hawaii Fire Rescue's probably had to respond more and more as our other counterparts throughout the state are responding to on the county level, to visitors going into these places that don't have the skill sets or knowledge, and then now they need help. So, and anyway, I never got a response, but I had to, in good conscience, as a manager, notify an esteemed periodical that I've loved since childhood and say, You got to stop this.
Be responsible.
Yeah.
Well, that shows what could, you know, that's the talk about good intentions gone awry, right? And,
mm-hmm.
You know, Catherine and I in the news have seen many, many rescues, helicopter rescues. And you mentioned first responders, and it's mm-hmm. it's worth mentioning that a cliffside rescue is a very dicey proposition for
Absolutely.
All concerned.
And the other thing, too, is I know over the 3 decades that I've been in news, how many grieving families you've had to deal with. Folks who have disappeared hiking, and the families come over here from the mainland, and they're just pouring their hearts out and just trying to search for their loved ones. And I just can't tell you how many stories like that we've covered over the years. It's just disheartening.
And it's not going away. You know, and it's increasing a bit.
There are several callers on the line. Let's hear from Leah on Maui. She lives in upcountry Maui. Good morning.
Aloha.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
You bet.
Hi. I'm a community health worker in training at the University of Hawaii at Maui College, and one of the things we did is we mapped some of our county parks. And when we did that, we discovered the value and importance of parks to communities. Mm-hmm. And what we found with the 6 or so parks that we mapped in Maui County, which is quite rural, was that our parks were underserved in accessibility and facilities, though we have great parks. And through improving our parks, we could generate greater social outcomes, whether it's lowering crime rates, increasing our property values and equity for the community, for giving our youth a lot of activities and our visitors opportunities to experience some of the local culture and flavor through improving our parks and charging fees. So I just wanted to point out that I believe this is something that's very future-oriented to implement fee charging and raising monies to bring in more facilities, whether it's more skate parks or slides or things that bring a lot of physical activity and enjoyment to all age groups, whether it's our young kids, our single moms, our single parents, our elderly, and making sure that all the parks are ADA compliant, that people can get to them who are, you know, have disabilities. So I think the ecotourism thing is going to be more and more important for Hawaii, for its character to the world and the culture and sustaining the beautiful ecosystems that we have.
Leo, thanks for your call. There's another caller on the line from Haiku, Maui, with a suggestion. Peter?
Yes, hi. A number of years ago, I don't know if it was the president or prime minister of Palau was over here speaking at the college. I think he came over to the islands to kind of explore what was going on here in terms of tourism. And he was talking about what they were doing over there to address the issues of taxing the environment. And what they had was a $50 green tax that they imposed on visitors, just dedicated toward protecting the environment. So I thought that was a brilliant idea, and I've always wondered why that couldn't be instituted here. Maybe $50 is too steep because of the amount of people we have coming here, but if it was even $10 a head or $20 a head and not put into the general fund, but just dedicated toward protecting our environmental resources, it could go a long way to providing funds for trail crews, for environmental protection, for coastline protection, for all kinds of things, waste management and so forth.
Is that a flat, one-time flat rate?
As you come in on the plane, you're taxed.
What do you folks think of that idea, Kurt, Alan?
I think it's the future. I think, you know, what Peter's saying is we've reached a point, there's a couple ways to skin the cat, so to speak, is directly add a surcharge to visitors and to a dedicated funding source. Obviously, I'd advocate for state parks. The other way is, you know, the hotel room tax, you know, is whatever its current rate. I don't know if it's 13 or 14%. We recently adjusted it for rail, you know, and so you could adjust the way the hotel room tax works as well to redistribute some of that revenue. You could either increase it a little bit and take that increase and dedicate it to environmental and recreational resources. So
it's capped right now.
Yeah,
to the neighbor islands.
Right, and so, but Peter's right. There, I think the visitor, knowing that an additional cost is going to be reinvested in the reason they're coming. And it's a question of what the pricing would be and the mechanisms of collection and whatnot. But absent, you know, us as a park entity generating our own income, it makes sense since we're at this threshold. Alan Carpenter, my assistant administrator, basically said the catchphrase, so he gets credit, we just need a buck a tourist. Well, that's $9.4 million new dollars for state parks. If we just charged a dollar a tourist and that $1 charge came to state parks, my current operating budget, absent this legislative session for 52 parks, is $12 million. That's all we get. This year we got a little bit more. We're at 13.5 for 52 parks and 30,000 acres. We only have 125 employees for you know, ostensibly the draw for the visitor industry. So you give us a buck a tourist, virtually doubles our budget.
Hey, make it 10.
Yeah.
And right. Alan, before folks go down to Hanama Bay, they have to watch a film. Are we doing enough to educate people? Should we be doing more on the airlines just to kind of give people a snapshot about, you know, the dangers of the trails, the dangers of these attractions?
Let me give a little bit of background first. The Hanama Bay management plan that the city adopted in 1990 said we're going to reduce the impact to Hanama Bay by first reducing the number of visitors we let in. And then they explained what type of restrictions we'll have in place. And then it said, went further, it said, for those that do get in, we're going to have a mandatory education program so that each visitor will know how to minimize their impact. And the best way to educate everybody would be to build an education center right on the route from the parking lot down to the beach and make everybody go through it. So when I was the manager, I'm going, how are we going to afford something like this? And it wasn't until the admission fee came into effect in 1990, which, again, we had apprehensions about charging to go to a public beach. But in 2002, we opened up this beautiful visitor center with a theater and exhibit areas, and it's well met by the public. And we never would have been able to get something like this if it wasn't for the admission fee, because the admission fee stays in account just for Hanama Bay and goes towards operating and improving the bay. So that's a very big plus in the advantages of having an admission fee. Ironically, before we put our restrictions in place in 1990, we were looking at what are other ways we could reduce the number of visitors, and it was proposed to possibly have an admission fee to reduce the number of visitors coming to Hanama Bay. And the guy that wrote the management plan, this guy named Robin Bond, who retired from the Parks Department, polled different tour companies and said, how much do you think you could get away with charging your customers before it would have a really negative effect upon your business? And we thought it'd be about $10. And it turned out that these operators, because they knew if we didn't come out with some other plan, restrictions were going to be put in. So they said, oh, we could probably get away with charging $30 to $40 per visitor. This was back in 1989.
Wow.
And there were two companies that said, we want you to charge $100 per visitor.
Whoa.
I only market to the upper-class upper-class clientele, and I will advertise Hanama Bay as someplace where my patrons don't have to associate with riffraff. Okay.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Yikes.
So we recognize a fault in our reasoning there in that as a public facility, we shouldn't determine who gets in
based
on their economic status. So admission fee to reduce the number of people is not good because you're going to hurt the common man. But an admission fee to help run your place, I think the public will be supportive of that.
You do limit the number of vehicles that go in there by the parking spaces.
Yes.
And you also give the resource a break by shutting it down one day a week.
Shutting it down one day a week, anything you can do to reduce the impact on the bay, the number of times people are there, will have an impact. But one day a week is so minimal. It's like, say, you're not going to let people walk around your garden one day a week so that the garden can recover. Probably it's not going to recover. But it allows us to do a lot of maintenance that we can't do when we're open to the public.
Oh, there you go.
There's a caller on the line on this very topic. Tom from Laupahoehoe. Can you hear me, Tom?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, yes. My name is Tom. I'm from Laupahoehoe. And I'm a retired Hawaii County police officer, so I got to deal with tourists on a daily basis and experience their impact. But when I retired back in 2008, I became a certified master gardener with the University of Hawaii. So I got to see not only the traffic impacts from before, but now I get to see the environmental impacts of, I believe, from tourism. And it seems like Hawaii County has taken the brunt of the ecological impacts. And I'll list a few: the varroa mite, the coffee borer, the kopi frogs, you name it, the ohia blight. So when I first came to Hawaii, the Marine Corps brought me here. And they sat us down in a classroom. They gave us an hour and a half to two-hour orientation on everything from traffic laws to how not to get to drown at Sunset Beach, and just basically how to live Pono as a visitor. And I was wondering, I heard the callers talk about an impact fee, but I think more than the impact fee, I really believe it's just the education of these people coming here before they arrive. And if if they do it with a travel agency or something, it's on the travel agency's shoulders to actually do that, to educate them, and I'll hang up.
That's a really interesting point. And, if a couple-hour classes, a lot of people have suggested that your plane ride might be a very good time for that.
Right, so we go back to that question. Are we doing enough on the planes?
I would say no, and that's been an enigma to me. I've made some attempts. It's really difficult to crack into that what is almost sacred time that the visitor sits on the airplane. To me, it's a squandered opportunity to do exactly what this gentleman just said. You're sitting on the plane. You could very easily craft a 45-minute thing that covers virtually all the stuff you need to know about all these topics we're discussing. And if we're going to continue at this magnitude, at least we should attenuate their behavior before they land. And that would be the way to do it.
Well, you're shown videos that remind you, there's some great Hawaiian music, all kinds of stuff about what a beautiful place you're coming to, which you may well know before you got on the plane.
Yeah.
And
that's why they're coming.
Exactly. So you're selling something that maybe has already been sold, and maybe this would be an opportunity. But has there been some resistance to that?
About 20 years ago or so, the Lifeguard Association came out with a short film to be shown on airplanes, and one of the airlines had committed themselves to showing it. And, it's realistically portrayed that the ocean is a different environment, a foreign environment to a lot of you, and there are hazards associated with this, and drowning is our number one cause of death of tourists here in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
The film was supposed to say this, and at the last minute, because none of the other airlines would get on board, this one airline that committed said, we cannot be the only one showing negative stuff to our passengers as they're coming to Hawaii. So they withdrew as well.
That's a shame.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because we've had a spike in drownings recently.
Yes. And this is something that should not only be shown on the airlines, but also in hotel rooms. They have the mm-hmm. television system every room. But it's going to take something really drastic before people say, yeah, we've got to do something about this.
And we did have attempts at the legislature the past couple of years to cap the number of tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't really gone anywhere. Can you talk about that?
Well, the bills I was keenly interested in, capping, I just don't know how you legally go about that. But there was discussion and bills that were and the discussion is lively at the legislature on this topic because constituents statewide, local communities are pushing back because of the impacts. The visitor industry now has permeated, local communities. But there's been a couple bills that once we hit a threshold of visitors, last session before last, if we hit $9 million, it goes back to a redistribution of the transit accommodation tax, going essentially, and this is the paradigm battle going on right now, is how much does the state of Hawaii continue to invest in marketing? And you indicated something I thought was very salient, is on the plane, people are seeing images of the stuff that they already knew was here, and so we're kind of preaching to the choir on the beauty. But the bill would have then redirected at a threshold of $9 million. Since we're not going to stop people, ostensibly, the limits are based on airplane flights and accommodations, which I think we've just added more flights. But I think the accommodations end is kind of maxed out. But the bills would have then redirected money into counties and state parks and resources to offset, the impacts. And there was a bill this session going, okay, we already hit 9, let's do it at 10. But the tricky part, and I acknowledge the challenge, is so you're at $10 million and suddenly at state parks I get an additional $6 million. But then flooding and lava happens and the visitor industry, the ratio drops to below 10. Do they take the money away from us? And so it's not a sustainable method to build a base budget. So while we supported the notion, we said, this is great, give us more money because we're getting hammered. Same time I said, it puts me in a position where I'm praying we get 10 million people, which I don't want to be in as a park manager. So,
Alan, anything you want to add in there?
Getting our community to act is a very difficult thing. I used to be in the dive tour business for many, many years, and when the restrictions went into effect in Hanama Bay, it mainly targeted the travel industry because they were overwhelmingly the main source of overcrowding in the bay, and a lot of companies went out of business, and it was hurtful to me to see this because I used to be in that business myself. And I mentioned at a meeting one time that it would have been nice if our restrictions had been in place 10 years earlier, before all these companies had evolved at Hanama Bay, only to be put out of business. We closed up about 70 different tour buses that were running, shutting people to Hanama Bay. But a planner in the meeting said, Alan, ideally that would have been nice, but in the real world, you cannot get your community to support any restrictions that are meant to address something 10 years in the future because we just can't see that far. The only time they're going to be supportive of a new restriction imposed by the government is when the problem has gotten so big and is staring you so much in the face that you can't deny anymore that something needs to be done. But what I think we have to do is really work on our decision makers, the elected officials, to think far in the future to get things in place before the problem actually arises, and then we have to do catch up and repair. And don't let these problems evolve to begin with, because it causes a lot more damage when you have to put in the restrictions then.
We've got a short time here. Anything you want to get out to the public? You've got hearings coming up on the rules in Hyena?
No. We're pretty much now moving into action.
Okay.
You know, at this point. But I just wanted, you know, if I get just a tiny bit of more time, an image to leave with people. And it kind of comes in with what Alan just said. And we are now responding, opposed to other states. We're ahead of the curve on climate change. And that's a really good example of we're trying to get the foresight now, because we're going to be heavily impacted. And you talk about impact to the tourism industry. Sea level rise is a game changer. But as a manager, I'm you know, you look at the state, and we're dealing with, you know, king tides and climate change possibilities and impacts to how we live and you know, shorelines either being armored or retreating. And so that's an increase. At the same time, we're dealing with
this. We're all the time.
Oh, sorry.
We'd like to thank our guests, Alan Hogg, former manager of Kanama Bay, and Kurt Cottrell, administrator of DLNR's Division of State Parks.
And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. If your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the talkback line and leave us your comments. That number, 808-792-8217.
You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.